In this week's episode, Justine takes us on a tour through time, and Donald Travis takes us to Albuquerque, both old and new.
Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talents in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
Let's get going then.
Okay.
So I've got three books. I've got three books here with a time travel thing. And I love time travel books. There really need to be more gay time travel books out there. I think I have read all of them on the market. And what I like, what my particular sweet spot is books that travel from the peasant, from the present to a particular point in the historical past, a real point in time. I don't really like when it goes to the future, and I don't really like when it goes to a alternate universe, because the author can make up whatever rules they want, and I really want to see how a character from now goes back and works out in the past.
Alternate universes are not my bag.
No, mine either. Now, I'll read them. I'll read pretty much anything. But this is really one of my favorite things, and there aren't enough books to do that. So I'm going to run through three of what I think are the best.
Sounds good.
Because of the dearth of selection, at least one of these is a romance. But as I get to it, I'll let you know what my thoughts are. Time travel itself is a bit of a mystery because, you know, they get tossed back in time and have to figure out how to get forward. So that's got its own mystery. And then the first book I have is adding a couple of mysteries. It's called Downtime by Tamara Allen. FBI agent is involved in a espionage, a pickup of a Russian agent that wants to come cross over and turn his back. And so he's involved in that mystery in the present. And in the middle of that, somebody's gone at gunpoint, and he gets pulled into the past, into Victorian era England. And there, he doesn't know quite why he's there, because the ghost of his ex-partner is visiting him and dropping hints. But he gets involved in solving the Jack the Ripper murder. And I like it because, one, it's very well written. It's got a couple of mysteries. He actually does find Jack the Ripper, but it doesn't change the future. And I'll let that all play out. That's as much of a spoiler as I'm going to give you. But it's got two mysteries, got some time travel. It's got some romance, kind of the middle of the road in the amount of romance is in there. But the romance is one of those that doesn't get tacked right on. It's seamless with the plot.
So it sounds kind of fun, but there's no time machine. He just gets sucked back in time.
None of these have a time machine. Well, one has a time machine, I guess.
Okay.
This one does not have a time machine. He's standing there, and all of a sudden, they're shooting. He thinks he's hit, and he loses consciousness and discovers that it wasn't that he's hit, it was that he's traveled back in time.
Okay, that sounds fun.
The second one is called Lost in Time by A.L. Lester, and this is the first of what will eventually be a trilogy. This one practices a bit of magic. There's a bit of an alternate world in this, and the alternate world is kind of just on the outside. He works some magic to keep the monsters away, but then his friend decides that she's going to use the magic to get herself something, and she accidentally gets traveled back in time, and he works and does a ritual where he gets traveled back in time. And he lands in post-World War I London. What's particularly unique about this book is that it takes him years to find the woman that he's looking for. Now, the book doesn't really travel too closely in his years. We get some vignettes over time. When he gets there, he has a terrible time adjusting. I suspect that he's more like what you and I would be if we got thrown through time. Oh, how do we get money? How do we get a job? How do we pull this off?
I like that because sometimes when people go back in time, they just kind of fit in, and that's not very realistic.
Right. And for example, in Downtime, the worst thing that happens is that occasionally he lets a bit of the future slip. And then he doesn't always know the events that were big then but haven't made it through history, like Grover Cleveland's wedding. You know, it's funny because if I said, well, in the future, we're going to do X, Y, Z, you would not think I was from the future. But he's always worried that he says, oh, we're going to be able to fly to the moon. People are going to go, you're from the future. That would not be a thing.
No.
And that's common in many time travel books, that there's that little tension. But that's a fun thing. Maybe if we were back, we would worry about that. But I don't know if it's a very realistic worry. But in the second book, and Lost in Time, he really does have a lot of trouble fitting in. And it takes him a good several years to fit in, then find his sister. There is, however, a monster which followed him through to the post-war era. So the way the monster appears to the people in the book who aren't our time travelers, it kills a lot of people. It, you know, needs to feed, and it looks like a serial killer is on the loose. So our other character, the main character in the past, is a police investigator named Alec. And so he's trying to solve this serial killer, and looking at our time traveler, Lou, is a good suspect for it. So you have that mystery going on, which even though it involves a creature, it really plays out more as a serial killer. The second book in the trilogy is not as much of a mystery. It's more of a, we know it's a monster now, and we're chasing the monster, and we're trying to get it. And then the third book, it looks like it hasn't been written, but it looks like it's going to be set in the alternate universe, because one of them gets sucked into that alternate universe. But that's not my cup of tea. This is well written, and the characters are good. So people who read these books, who read the first one, may be more interested in the trilogy or in the later books than our gay mystery readers would be. I'm going to read them no matter what. But if you're really into gay mysteries, the second and third book are going to be less interesting. But the first one's a true mystery.
As long as that mystery is there.
That's it, yes. The third one does not really fit into the gay mystery genre, even though it has time travel in it, which in itself does a mystery.
Shame on you.
Shame on me, but it's written by Marshall Thornton, who has written the Boys Town series and the Pink. Oh, see? Okay, yeah. All the gay mystery readers are like going, okay, I'm back. So it's called Aunt Belle's Time Traveling Collectibles, and it's different from the others, where our time traveler, Terrence, he goes into the shop owned by Aunt Belle, and she has this makeshift time machine in the back. But the rules of time travel in this book are that you can only go back to your own past and inherit your own body at that time. You can't change the timeline because your travels have already taken place. So Terrence has a series of blackouts in his past where he does things, and then the next day people tell him about him. He assumes he's blackout drunk, but thinks these things are things he would never do. And who he is at that time would never do them either. So now he's traveling back and trying to fix it and doing the very things that he did in the blackout. So it's really a circular time paradox. And I can't really get too much into it in time we have, but you got a couple 200, 300 pages to sit down and really tease that concept out. And Terrence is very likable. Aunt Belle is really a fun character, really delicious. And the love interest in the future is Sean, and the love interest in the past is David. David was Terrence's great love at the time, and 20 years later discovers that, he's been skimming money and doing drugs. And so in the present, he's trying to go back and fix that issue. So what he does is when he travels back in time, he talks about how bad and awful David is. And then the next day he doesn't remember it and tells everybody how wonderful and lovely David is. And they're staring at him like he's nuts.
give us again the three books and the authors.
Okay. Downtime by Tamara Allen, Lost in Time by A.L. Lester, and Aunt Belle's Time Travel and Collectibles by Marshall Thornton.
Sounds good. Now, you have some news from We Queer Tales today. It's going to be, this involves our good friends over at the Big Gay Fiction Podcast.
Yeah, next week, Monday, in just a couple days, Matt Lubbers-Moore, who has been on this program, one of my partners in Recruit Tales, they'll be airing an interview with him on Monday on the Big Game Fiction Podcast. Next year, we have about 25 to 30 books coming out for by Recruit Tales. Our first book, which is now on pre-order, is what we think is the first Black lesbian detective in the genre ever to be published back in the late 80s. It's called In the Game by Nikki Baker, and it's available for pre-order. And it is the first Black lesbian, she's not a detective, she's an accountant in the high-flying late 80s financial market. And she gets sucked into a mystery as an amateur detective. It's the first in a series, and we just love this character.
You know, I say every week, oh, I can't wait to read this book, but this one's really drawn my attention.
Yeah, it's a good read. It's well written. And Nikki Baker, who worked in finance in her real life, it stopped writing after a while, you know, because it was just a sideline.
I'm glad you're bringing her back.
Yeah, we're happy to bring in her books back. So that's all I have here. Who do you have up today, Brad?
I have Don Morgan, who actually writes under the name Don Travis for his mystery novel series. It's the B.J. Vincent mystery series, and it's quite an entertaining interview.
Great. It's a new-to-me author. I'm looking forward to hearing him talk about his books and maybe picking up his books in the future.
Yeah, he even admits that he is not good at promotion. He doesn't like it at all. What I've heard and understand, I think if he did promote, he would be much better known.
Well, maybe our podcast will give him a boost.
Let's hope so. Okay, well, we'll see you. This is New Year's Eve that you and I are recording this, so it will be the new year. So happy New Year to you and everyone else out there.
Happy New Year to you, Brad.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, gaymysteryauthors.com.
My guest today is Don Morgan, or you may know him under one of his pen names, Mark Wilder or Don Travis. His series under Mark Wilder is one of his historical Native American series, which we will discuss briefly. Don Travis is a pseudonym for his sixth book, B.J. Vincent Murder Mystery Series, which is where we'll begin. Originally from Oklahoma, Don currently lives in Loves, New Mexico, the land of enchantment. Welcome, Don. I'm happy to have you on today.
Well, thank you very much, Brad. I appreciate you giving me this opportunity.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let's start with your protagonist, B.J. Vincent. In three sentences, how would you describe him?
He is a former Marine, ex-cop, private investigator, who passionately loves his work, his city of Albuquerque and state of New Mexico, and his life companion, Paul Barton. He's very much a man of his times.
Well, he sounds like an interesting character, and I love hearing that he has a longtime partner, which we don't always hear in a lot of the mystery series. Tell us about the B.J. Vincent series in general.
Okay. I started the B.J. Vincent series with a book called The Sosobra Incident, which takes place up in Albuquerque, but also part of the action occurs in Santa Fe at a Santa Fe Fiesta and there is a big burning of Zasobra, a giant marionette, that occurs on the first day of the fiestas. There's something like 40,000 people in this huge park, and a murder takes place right in the middle of it. So that started me off, and I thought that was probably the end of it, but BJ began pestering me, and so I went back to the typewriter or to the computer and wrote the second one, which I called the Beastie Business. It takes place in the Four Corners area near the Beastie Wilderness. And frankly, I think that turned out to be a better book, mostly because I was a little more passionate about the landscape up there, but also because by now Paul's a part of his life, and I like the interplay between the two. Mm-hmm. So after that, I just went on and wrote another and another and another. There's six of them now published, and I've got 40,000 words of the seventh one in the computer.
So we've got another seven coming, and number seven coming along soon.
Number seven, called The Cutie Pie Murders.
I love that title. Do you find writing a book series more challenging?
Actually, no. I tend to get involved in my characters, and almost everything I've written turns into a character, into a series, regardless of what name I write under. I do find it a little bit challenging in writing a standalone book so that a reader who hasn't read Zasobra, for example, can pick up the Vox Leitner scandal, read it and understand it, and understand who the characters are and the relationships between them. But other than that, I like carrying on my characters. I get to know them better and better each time I write.
So if I understand correctly, each one of these is a standalone novel, or can be read as a standalone novel?
It can be. There will be references to prior cases, but they're one-liners or two-liners. And now, in the case of Abaddon's Locusts, I went back and picked up a character that I really did like, who came out of the Bistai business, a young man by the name of Jazz Penrod, who's half Navajo and half Anglo. And he was such an engaging character that I brought him over and made him the victim of a sex trafficking ring and involved BJ and Paul and getting him out of their clutches and rehabilitating him.
Well, if anybody that listens to my show, they know I do not like cliffhangers. I am not a fan. So I'm happy to hear that you do each book as a standalone. So good on you.
Thank you.
Now, your most recent novel, The Vox Leitner Scandal, it came out in November. Is that correct?
Yes, November 19 from Dream Spinner Press.
And what can you reveal about that story?
Well, BJ and Paul are at it again. If you will allow me later on, I'm going to read the prologue from it, and it'll tell you a little bit about it.
Of course.
Paul is has now graduated from the University of New Mexico. He's got his master's, and he's becoming a journalist, an online journalist, as a matter of fact. He writes and sells his stuff independently. And he knows a writer associated from a group called Southwest Writers, which is actually Albuquerque or New Mexico's largest professional organization for authors, writers, and publishers. And he knows this writer who was killed. Who lived about four blocks from where BJ and Paul live in the Northwest Valley of Albuquerque. And so Paul's bound determined he's going to get to the bottom of it, because while it's being portrayed as an accident, Paul knew the guy well enough to know that he wouldn't do what he was expected of doing in order to get himself killed, which was work on a gas-fired mower and get gas on him and ignite it and burn himself up. So that draws BJ into it, and lo and behold, that opens things up to one of Albuquerque's oldest and biggest scandals, a ripoff that happened years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, when somebody formed a company to do a metals, precious metals recovery program and stole roughly $40 million out of the economy of New Mexico, which is not an insignificant thing for a state of this size.
Mm-hmm.
So do they have one mystery or do they have two? Do they have, is the death of this author, whose name is Bellingham, is Bellingham's death connected to the scandal which he was working on solving, or was it something else? So do they have two mysteries to solve or one? And that's pretty much how Voxleitner goes.
Well, it sounds like a lot of twists and turns, and Bellingham sounds like he certainly had a gruesome death. So that's always a fun way to begin. Now, as for you, you have a diverse background. You studied government and history in college.
Correct.
You spent some time in the military. And
correct.
Artistically, you did some oil painting as well.
Yes, for a few years.
How does one go from all of that to a man who's published 60 short stories in 16 novels?
Well, I was tubercular as a child, Brad. I had tuberculosis when I was 6 years old, spent 3 months in the hospital, which really impacted a kid, a shy kid, a mama's boy, frankly. So I grew up in the library instead of on the playing fields of sports fields. And when I went into the Army, and these were the days of the draft, so when I went in the Army voluntarily in order to be able to name where I wanted to go rather than waiting to be drafted, I already had my college degree and knew where I would end up as a clerk, and that's exactly what happened. But growing up as a kid and living in the library, I would sit down and I was fascinated by different cultures, especially Native American cultures. And I would do little themes on that, I'd research them and do little themes. And then these little themes went into little short stories, none of which survived. But that's the way I got started. When I came out of the Army, I frankly got married and started my work life, there was nothing scratching my creative itch. So I had always figured that maybe I'd paint because I could draw reasonably well. So I did that and was reasonably successful at it. I only have one of my own paintings left. All the rest of them I sold for a modest amount of money. But nonetheless, they were good enough for somebody to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured that's the way I'm going to live out my life. But I ran into a rough patch in my life, and I found that painting didn't do the job anymore, because when I would get toward the end of a painting, I would get very uptight over, am I going to screw it up before I finish it? And I didn't need more stress in my life, so I put down the brush, never picked it up again, and started writing again. And I wrote for a long time and submitted, and I got nowhere. And one day I went to a bookstore with a friend. It wasn't my wife. It was someone else. And while he was looking for what he wanted, I sat down on the chair there and looked on the table, and there was a book there. And it was one of these god-awful books where it was sex, nothing but sex. There wasn't even a story to it. It was just one sex act after another. And I said, I can do better than that. So I took down the name of the publisher. I went home. I wrote a story. I submitted it. I sold him that one and 17 others. Before he got in legal trouble because of a suit by an author. But he directed me to another place, and they and others bought a total of about 60 short stories, all gay-themed in nature. But that gave me a niche market, and I wanted to write novels. So I sat down and I wrote. The first novel I wrote was actually as Mark Wilder, and it was very sexual in nature, but it was one of the Native American historical novels. And to me, it's not a sex book, it's a historical book. Some will read it and say, no, it's a sex book, but I've had others say, no, it's a historical novel, a love story. And that's the way I got started, Brad. And after a while, I decided I wanted to write a little less graphically. So I had the idea of B.J. Vinson. And since I named him Burley J. Vinson, it was a lot easier to call him B.J. And that's the way things came about.
Well, Don, I agree. There's a big difference to me between erotica and a book that happens to have a lot of sex.
Yeah.
Very different animals. So
absolutely.
And so what was the biggest surprise that you experienced after becoming a writer?
Well, again, I have to go back to not the B.J. Vinson series, but to the Cut Hand series, which mm-hmm. was the first novel by that I wrote as Mark Wilder. And that was the response from readers. I got all kinds of responses, 99% of them very, very supportive, and 1 or maybe 2% of them, poo-pooing the idea and too much sex, or you could see us coming a mile off and that sort of thing. But both of them were very laudatory. And to me, the most beneficial thing was that a lot of them said, I learned something when I read this book. And that's what I wanted to do, because my whole goal in writing the Cut Hand series was to show the way that some, not all, but some of the Native American tribes treated two-spirits or gay people with respect, and gave them, in some cases, honored positions. And the way that changed with the coming of the Europeans, and as the Europeans, the Anglos, became the dominant culture, the impact that had on the way that the Native Americans considered their gay people. And it was dramatic over the course of the books. So that was probably the most surprising thing, the reader reaction.
And now that you've touched on it, you've kind of already covered it, but you write the Cut Hand series under the Mark Wilder series. And as you said, it is not a mystery series, but it is something you're very passionate about. And the two-spirit ideal that they had is very fascinating to me. So if you want to go on a little more about that, I'm okay with that. We can get back to the other story.
Okay. When I finished with Cut Hand, which starts in 1830, and ends during the Civil War, so it spans 30-some-odd years, I have this young man who is the son of Tories from the American Revolution. And the Tories were treated very badly after the war, as you might expect they would be. And they lost their land, and they became tenant farmers. So when he ran into prejudices about the Tories, after his parents died in a fire in his cabin, he discovered some English pounds in there, some silver pounds. And he decides it's time to leave this country. So he comes to the West and ends up in the Dakota Territories with two seasoned frontiersmen. And they travel their way across the territory, and they have occasion, and it's complicated, so I won't involve it, but they have occasion to capture a very handsome young Siouan. It's not a Sioux tribe. I made him, it's a fictitious tribe that I made Sioux related, son of a chief. And lo and behold, Billy Strobaugh, my protagonist, discovers he has feelings for this young man, and he had never experienced feelings that way before. So he wrestles with himself and with his belief in God, but can't help himself. He involves himself with the captive while the captive is helpless. from that grows a love story in which Billy abandons his own people and goes to live with Cut Hands people. I really enjoy writing those books.
Yeah, and it shows. Now, those are under your Mark Wilder pen name.
Yeah, which I spell W-I-I-L-D-Y-R.
Well, let's go back to Don Travis, the mystery side of yourself.
Okie doke.
Which mystery authors inspired you?
My favorite author is a fellow by the name of James Lee Burke. James Lee Burke is a Louisiana writer who just, he handles the English language so well and the Cajun language so well. He starts his chapters off with soaring poetic descriptions of his environment. I mean, you live in the swamp that he's in. You can see and hear and smell exactly what he wants you to see, hear, and smell. But he's not, he doesn't have gay characters. These are straight books, but they are mysteries. And he has two series. One of them is Dave Robichaux series, and he's a flawed ex-cop. Well, actually, he still is a cop, but he's been thrown off of a couple of of the forces, and he is quite an individual. He's a heavy drinker, tends toward alcoholism, so he has his flaws, but he also solves mysteries.
Well, I'll have to look him up. Sounds like a good series, and I love somebody that can take me to where they are.
Oh, he can do it. He can do it. I wish that I could do it. As a matter of fact, in the piece that I'm going to read you, it mentions both Southwest writers and James Lee Burke. Oh. Just by coincidence.
Well, before we get to that, I wanted to ask you one last question, and that is, many would find success based on your number of published works, which, if my math is right, came to 76, I believe, between your short stories and your novels, or at least right. Somewhere in that neighborhood. But what does literary success mean to you?
Well, I certainly can't say it's a number of books sold, because while I think I write reasonably well, I am a horrible self-promoter, and I detest the modern media. I do a blog, and I post it on Twitter and mention it on Facebook, and that's it. That's about all I do. Consequently, my numbers are not that great, but they do make me a little bit of money. And I forget what the question was. What's the most satisfying?
What do you consider literary success?
Oh, what do I consider literary success? I consider literary success when I finish a novel and I have it come out and I receive a reaction from my readers. If I don't have a reaction from my readers, I'm not sure that I have done anything for them. And I revel in reader reactions. That to me is success, promoting somebody else, prompting somebody else to get in touch with you and say, geez, I read your book and I really liked it. Or even, geez, I read your book and I hated it. I provoked the reaction, and that to me is success.
Well, I can't disagree with anything you just said. So I agree. If you don't get to the emotion, to the heart of the individual, then it doesn't matter what your sales are.
That's right.
Now, you offered to share a passage from your mystery, The Vox Lightner Scandal, and I'd like to give you the opportunity now to do so.
Okay. What I would like to do for the listeners is just simply read the prologue from Vox Lightner Scandal. I am old-fashioned enough, Brad, that I have every one of my books has a prologue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm told it's out of date, but I don't care. I use the prologue normally in the omniscient voice, although the one I'm going to read you today is not in the omniscient, and to set the mood for the entire book, and it's just a little piece in time, and I want to read now, so I'll read this one. This is the prologue to the Vox Leitner scandal. Albuquerque, New Mexico, July 20, 2011. At ease in his comfortable North Valley home, Pierce brushed his chin with a palm, raising the irritating rasp of a 5 o'clock shadow. The house lay silent, disturbed only by his knocking around in the den and the tick-tock of the ornate wind-up clock resting on the mantelpiece. Overhead lights off, a reading lamp cast a soft pool of light, rescuing the room from darkness. He longed for the mellow smell of pipe tobacco, but he had given up the vice last winter after a suspected TIA, a transient ischemic something or other. Ensconced in his favorite recliner, he picked up a book from the coffee table and inspected it closely, his latest novel, his third, just delivered from the publisher this morning. In a rare moment of brutal honesty, he silently admitted the most impressive thing on the cover was his name, John Pierce Belhaven, a good cognomen for an author. It rolled off the tongue and lent gravitas to the banal title, Macabre Desserts. Although too egotistical to confess to being a hack, in moments such as this, he silently acknowledged he was no James Lee Burke. Whenever he attempted the Louisiana writer's soaring poetic passages, they ended up as muddy puddles of worthless ink. What was Elmore Leonard's rule number 10? Leave out the parts nobody wants to read. His next book would be The Bleeding Edge, as the younger set would say, and they would be right. His best writing to date, possibly his signature work, a mystery like the others. The plot would taking shape in his brain solved a real puzzle, one that had plagued Albuquerque for years. A scandal involving the theft of millions and the death of a respected attorney. A mystery only he could solve because he had a leg up on the competition. Years ago, in his capacity as a utility company executive, he had uncovered a crucial clue but hadn't understood its significance until he researched this new book. He drew a deep breath as if pulling on a forbidden meerschaum. This new work would carry him from humdrum to bestseller. In his interview with Wilma Hardesty on KALB-TV, aired that very afternoon, put the world on notice he was reopening the moribund Vox Leitner case with a hard-hitting expose leading directly to the killer. All it would take was a little more investigating. Connect a few more dots and he would be able to cut the Gordian knot. He reached for a tumbler resting on the lamp table beside his chair and inhaled the rich aroma of Balanchine single malt before savoring its smooth, nutty, slightly honeyed taste. This new book he was laboring over would set him on their ears. It set them on their ears down at Southwest Writers, making them sit up and take notice. He would rigorously guard against going pedantic, one of his weaknesses. Solid prose and startling action. That was the approach for this budding masterpiece. He quelled an urge to rush to the office on the other side of his house to rifle through the growing file of research on the case. A noise from the garage brought him out of his chair. He glanced at the clock. 10:34. Who could that be at this time of night? Melanie? He shook his head. His daughter was home in Grants with their odious husband. Nor would his estranged son Harrison show up at his door. Probably not even to pick up his inheritance, should Pierce condescend to leave him one. He placed his new book on the coffee table and walked to the interior garage door. As he arrived, the gas-powered lawnmower roared to life. What the hell? John Pierce Belhaven twisted the knob and stepped from his kitchen into hell. That's it.
Well, that's a grabber. And I I want to tell you, first of all, there are plenty of people that are still writing prologues, so don't think you're the only one out there.
And, oh, I know.
secondly, as far as this listener goes, if your goal is to take the reader there, you had me there in that room. So good on you. Well done.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you being a guest on the show. And just to help everyone once again, your series, the Native American series, is under Mark Wilder, which is W-I-L-D-Y-E-R.
D-Y-R. D-Y-R.
Oh, I'm sorry. D-Y-R. And right. Don Travis is the series that you write the B.J. Vincent mysteries under. And the book that you just read from is your latest book, The Weichsleitner Scandal.
Correct.
Okay, and what's the best direction for someone to go if they wanted to purchase that novel?
They can go to any bookstore, and if it's not there, they can ask to order it, or you can order it directly through Amazon, or you can order it directly through the publisher, which is Dream Spinner Press.
It's pretty much available everywhere.
So far as I can tell, that's been the experience I've had. Mostly if I go to find a book that the bookstore isn't carrying, I just ask them to order it. They look it up and they order it for me. Yeah.
Well, thank you once again. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show, and I appreciate your help, Brad.
You can find us on all major podcast applications. Be sure to subscribe to our show and not miss a single episode. Thank you for listening.